Today on the 21st Show, our ongoing series of conversations with the men and women running to be the next U.S. Senator from Illinois after Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election. Kevin Ryan grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago, served as an officer in the Marine Corps, and became a teacher in the Chicago Public Schools. He's one of 10 people running for the Democratic Party's nomination. We'll talk with him about domestic policy, foreign affairs, and politics in an era dominated by President Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. We also want to put your questions to Kevin Ryan, so call in throughout the hour at 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The decision by U.S. Senator Dick Durbin not to seek re-election has led to a generational opportunity in Illinois, with 10 Democrats and another half-dozen Republicans seeking their party's nominations in the March primaries. We've heard from several of those candidates over the last few months. You can find those interviews at our website, 21stshow.org. In the coming weeks leading up to the primary election in March, we hope to bring you more live, in-depth conversations with as many of the candidates as we can. Today, my guest is Kevin Ryan, a former teacher and United States Marine. A brief biography, he grew up in Orland Park in the south suburbs of Chicago. He went to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign to become a teacher, and after graduation went to work in the Chicago Public Schools. During this time, he also served as an infantry officer in the Marine Corps, deploying to Afghanistan. When he got back stateside in 2020, he left his teaching job, kept traveling, earning a graduate degree in diplomacy at the University of Oxford and another degree in national security from Georgetown in Washington. He continued his military service and also worked in the Treasury Department in the Biden administration. Now he is running for United States Senate and joins me today in our studios in Urbana. Kevin Ryan, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we have a lot of ground to cover. I'm aiming to talk about his background, foreign affairs, domestic policy, some big picture themes in American government and politics. And we also want to include your questions for Mr. Ryan. You can join the conversation throughout the hour at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, let's start with your background. What inspired you to become a teacher?
Well, the teachers that I had in high school were a large inspiration for that. So I had my brother growing up struggled with mental illness and addiction, and that made life at home rather difficult. And my teachers played an instrumental role in my life of helping me get through that period. And when I was a student here at the University of Illinois, well, as a freshman, the summer of my freshman year, he died by overdose. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
And yeah, I mean, it is what it is. And that was a difficult time as well, coming back to the university. And the teachers that I had in high school were large mentors for me in getting me through that time. And I kind of had this moment where, I spent a lot of my life hating him because he made life at home very difficult for our family. And I realized after he died that I wasn't really there for him as a brother. And teaching served as a way for me to almost make amends, to be there for people who otherwise didn't have anyone to turn to. And so that's what I did. I tried to be for my students what I couldn't be for my brother. And my first student teaching experience was in Danville High School. And that's when I opened up to students for the first time about my experience growing up with my brother, his life and his death. And opening up to students like that allowed me to connect with them. And a lot of students started coming to me and telling about their own personal stories. And that started this journey into teaching that has been one of the most rewarding experiences of my life.
And how did you end up in Chicago Public Schools?
Well, Chicago's home. And I consider Chicago Public Schools the front line of public education, if you will. And so I wanted to go where I could make the most meaningful impact.
And at this time is when you also decide to join the Marine Corps, yeah?
Yes.
How did that come about?
So at the time, people my age were still going overseas to Iraq and Afghanistan.
When is this roughly?
So I commissioned in 2014, but I started the process in 2012 while I was a student here. And people were, again, people my age, people my classmates from high school were joining the military and they're being sent overseas. And I thought, why them and not me? And so then I went to the officer selection officer here in Champaign and started the process. And after I graduated in 2014, 2 weeks later, I went from a big house of 10 guys on First and John to Marine Corps boot camp. it was quite the culture shock.
Officer candidate school and so you decided to become an infantry officer, or were you assigned to that? Or
So what's funny, when I talked to the selection officer, he asked me what MOS I wanted. And I kind of looked at him confused, like, is there anything else besides infantry?
every man a rifleman, right?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, no, I wanted to join the Marine. You join the Marine Corps. In my view, I wanted to be an infantry officer because that's what I saw the Marine Corps as, is the Marine Corps infantry.
When did you deploy to Afghanistan?
2019.
Okay, so toward the end.
Yes.
What was that like?
It was very interesting experience because it was the tail end of the war. We were more of an occupying force than anything else. And most interestingly, we were there while the first Trump administration, entered into the truce, the ceasefire with the Taliban, which didn't include the Afghan government. And what was really interesting from my perspective on the ground was, you know, there was this ceasefire. However, the Taliban stopped attacking us. But they just took off the Taliban hats and put on ISIS hats, and ISIS started attacking us. So it was the same people, but they wanted to maintain the integrity of the truce, so they called themselves they told us it was a different enemy that was shooting rockets at us.
I know you had an experience while you're there, you've talked about anyway, where the president spoke.
Yes.
At an event. What was that about? What was that like?
So I believe that was Thanksgiving. He came into, he flew into Bagram Airfield, which my unit was responsible for defending the base, largest base in Afghanistan. And it was a surprise visit. No one knew about it. They told us that the Army Chief of Staff was going to be addressing us, but instead it was President Trump. He came and addressed the troops there. So I was one of them that volunteered to go, and I brought some troops with me. And it was an interesting experience because it kind of felt like a political rally, and that felt weird to me as a uniformed officer. So I didn't like engage in any clapping or anything like that. Like the generals we saw in Quantico when they were assembled, I stood at parade rest and listened to the commander in chief speak. And that's how I believe everyone should have acted. But there was it was a little bit like a rally in some ways.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the United States Senate. Why do you want to be a U.S. senator?
It's a great question, because whenever you get into politics, the office that you're going for is, you know, people tell you you want to do the thing that you want to do. If you want to be on school board, run for school board. If you want to be in the state house, run for state house. Don't run for something else to try and get there, is what I was trained to do. And so I want to amend the Constitution, and the best way that I think to do that is by running for the United States Senate. I could run for the House. I've had people tell me I have a very competitive background. I'm very articulate and knowledgeable about the issues, and I could probably win a House seat somewhere in Illinois. But I see myself in the House as being a member of a caucus, and we've seen the progressive wing of the Democratic Party be rather ineffective in the House because of its majority rule under the caucus. So I take inspiration from a little-known senator from Kansas back in the progressive era named Joseph Bristow. He did not have any political experience. He never held office before, but he ran on a single issue, and that was to amend the Constitution to change the election of senators from the state houses to direct popular election. He ran on that issue, he won on that issue, and then in a single term, he introduced into the Senate, passed through both the House and the Senate, and saw ratified by 3/4 of the states the 17th Amendment. That allows me to appeal to you instead of the state house in Springfield to run for the United States Senate. So that is my goal, to amend the Constitution, to take money out of politics, to establish that money is not speech, corporations are not people, and that Congress has the authority to regulate spending in elections.
Shorthand, overturn Citizens United.
Overturn
other decisions.
Not just Citizens United, yeah. Buckley versus Vallejo as well, yes.
Yeah. There are going to be, well, you I was going to save this for later, but you got into it. So, I mean, there are going to be people who hear this and think, who is this guy? You know, you're like, you know, nobody joins the Marine Corps and says, make me a brigadier general, right? Mm-hmm. So why not work your way up, learn about how the process of politics works in a state house, as you said?
Well, for two reasons. One, the state house is very different from the United States Senate. The United States Senate is very different from the United States House of Representatives. You know, one is majority rule, one is minority rule, right? It's defense is the Senate, offense is the House. But I believe, and the other answer to that question is, the climbing the ladder strategy, I think, produces ineffectual outcomes. Because you get into politics and then you start saying to yourself, I just need to do this and then I'll be able to do that. And then you keep doing that and then you lose some of those ideals along the way. And by the time you get to a position of influence, such as being one of 100 United States senators, you've been corrupted a little bit along the way. And so I think the United States Senate desperately needs some virgin inspiration that has been untainted by our broken political process. And that's what I'd like to bring to it. Also, I'd refer you to John Ossoff in Georgia. I don't think anyone cared about his experience because he had $130 million. So that's the other thing, right? It's not really about the experience. If I came into this race with $130 million, I'd be all over the place. People would want to know what I think, shake my hands, talk to me, see me on TV. But because I don't have $130 million, oh, he doesn't have any experience or money, so he doesn't belong here.
Well, that is a big difference. To be fair, I took issue with Governor J.B. Pritzker when he was a first-time candidate for governor who had no elective office experience.
Sure,
as well.
And for the executive,
but he
$3 billion. Right, and I agree with you there. And I think the executive is very different, right? As being a legislator, in a body, that's very different from being an executive. And I think the experience matters much more at the executive level, whether you're going to be a mayor of a large city or a governor or a president. I do think that executive experience matters a little bit more because the buck falls all on you.
So you talked about your big overriding goal is going to be campaign finance reform, right? It's interesting to me that you think the Senate is the place to get that done, because it strikes me that the Senate is the place where ideas go to die in 2026, right? This, as you said, it's a minoritarian rule. There's a filibuster. What would be your path for overcoming that?
So the Senate gives reformers the breadth and independence they need to enact reform. If we look at the history of campaign finance reform, it has only ever happened by an outside reformer coming in and forcing a reluctant Congress to pass campaign finance reform. Now, 72% of Americans support spending limits. That's including 71% of Republicans. Now, no Republicans in the Senate support it. But what I will do after I get elected on the general election on November 3rd, you know, we have from November 3rd to January 3rd when he gets sworn in. And I got this big green school bus that I've been driving across the state, the only candidate in the race to visit all 102 counties. And I don't know the last time a Democrat visited all 102 counties. A lot of these counties are red, as we know. But I bring that message there about taking money out of politics, about reforming our elections that publicly finance campaigns and campaign spending limits, and Republican voters are on board with that. 71% of them are, and I have the data and I have the anecdotal experience to back that up. So between November 3rd and January 3rd, I will get in my school bus and I will take a circuitous route to Washington, D.C. to get sworn in, stopping in the red states and holding rallies with my joint resolution to amend the Constitution in the three ways I described to you. And we're going to generate the popular support necessary to force the will of Congress to reflect the popular will. It's the most bipartisan issue there is out there. The only people who don't want to change it are those who benefit from it, and because it maintains their incumbency and protects them from being challenged.
All right, so I want to let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Kevin Ryan, my guest for the hour today, who is one of the people running in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate in Illinois this year. You can join our conversation today at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's stick with domestic policy since we started there. How would you rate America's economy over the past year?
Well, if we're talking about affordability, not good.
Say more.
So, like, I have a very unique perspective of when I was in the military in Washington, D.C. You know, I'm stationed in an American city. I get access to the commissary, which is a nonprofit government-run grocery store. So they sell their products at surface level value of what it costs to put that thing on the shelf and keep the lights on. The dog food I'd get for my dog would be $15 at the commissary. If I went to a different store just down the street outside the base, it would be $25. So the affordability crisis is very real, but it's multifaceted. And part of that is corporate control and corporate greed that's able to manipulate markets, manipulate prices, and put that onto the consumers because they have no other choice. So if we're talking about the economy, when I look at the economy, I look at what are people able to afford to live? How are they able to afford to live? Do they earn enough to live, save for the future, raise a family, and enjoy what time they have on this planet? That is what the economy should be focused on. And so whatever any metrics we use about like shareholder value in the stock market, I don't really care about that because only a minority of this country profits off of that those profits driven in the stock market. I look at the economy as wages and affordability and cost of living, and it's going down, right? Affordability is going people can't afford to live because prices are going up and wages are remaining stagnant. So it's not good.
So we have just about a minute and a half until we need to take a break. What does a United States senator do about that?
Well, again, and we're going to talk about this a lot as we go through this. The source of every issue is money in politics because corporations have this outsized control over our policy. We have existing monopoly law. Why isn't it enforced? Why aren't we strengthening it? It's because corporations are able to use their tremendous wealth to protect their profits so they can get even more wealth. So talk about affordability and price gouging at corporate grocery store chains. They're using that wealth to circumvent our laws to basically gouge consumers. So that's one way. It all comes back to money in politics.
What about lobbying? Is that part of this equation for you?
Of course. Yeah, lobbying. Yeah. I mean, lobbying is money in politics, right? Yeah. It's just a different form of it.
Okay. This is the 21st show. We're speaking with Kevin Ryan. He's a Democrat running for his party's nomination for the United States Senate, one of 10 people seeking that party nomination in the election that's coming up in March. You can join us today, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. I also want to say you can find some of our other interviews in this series on our website, 21stshow.org. We've already spoken with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, Congresswoman Robin Kelly, Don Tracy, who used to be chairman of the Illinois Republican Party. We have more interviews scheduled in the days and weeks ahead. Submit your questions to us for the candidates on our website, 21stshow.org. We're going to get to some of your questions after this break. Again, you can join us live now, 800-222-9455. It's the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with Kevin Ryan, a candidate in the Democratic primary for the United States Senate here in Illinois. He's with us for the hour. You can share your questions at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. On that note, we got a text message from one of our listeners. Lloyd in Danville wants to know your opinion on outsourcing of jobs and how you feel the loss of such jobs have affected living wages in Illinois.
Yeah, I've seen that across the state. So like I said, I've been to 102 counties. A lot of these counties are red. And going to these places helps me understand conservative voters and why people might have voted for Trump as opposed to one of the Democratic candidates in 2016 or 2024. And you see these towns be hollowed out by the loss of manufacturing jobs, last mineral extraction jobs, and corporate takeover of agriculture. And so I support keeping jobs in the United States. I support bringing jobs back in the United States. And I think we really need to make a push to support union-made products and union-made manufacturing in the United States. It's going to cost more for consumers, so not everyone can do it. But there's a good amount of people in the United States who can. So all the people who buy designer clothes, or if you shop at Macy's, for example, you can afford to buy union-made products. And so I would like to see a corporate tax incentive to make manufacturers bring manufacturing back to the United States, especially in some of our rural towns. And also like to see like a government campaign to promote buying U.S.-made, union-made products to help support American workers.
President says he's aiming to bring manufacturing jobs back to America as well. What do you think of his approach to that?
I would love to bring jobs back to the United States, manufacturing jobs. Tariffs, I'm not sure, are the right way to do it. I think corporate tax incentives are the better way to do it. But if at the end of the day, I'm a policy person. I don't believe in isms. I believe in policy. And if the president is able to bring jobs back to the United States, that is a win.
Sticking with domestic policy, immigration enforcement has obviously been top of mind for us in the last week and really in the last months here in Illinois. Abolish ICE was once a fringe position held by people on the far left, but there's a new Economist YouGov poll out in the last day or so found significant support for the concept, 46% in favor, 43% opposed, the rest unsure. Should we, in fact, abolish Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency?
Yes. It has gone well beyond its scope, and their aggressive abuses of power and use of force are it's so egregious that we need to get rid of it, and we need to set up something new that doesn't have the same kind of law enforcement capability and funding that ICE has.
How should future administrations and members of Congress pursue accountability for what's happening now? Right, from wearing masks, not being in uniform, for example, to should there be prosecutions, congressional investigations? Take it where you will.
Yeah, well, first of all, let's start with having an independent Department of Justice. I mean, this administration has totally politicized the Department of Justice. One of the first times in history, even Nixon, despite his best efforts, wasn't able to politicize or control the Department of Justice. So we need to have an independent Department of Justice, and they absolutely need to conduct investigations. We can have congressional investigations, but those usually are somewhat toothless. So I would like to see the Department of Justice investigating every single account of an abuse of power or excessive use of force by any federal law enforcement officer.
How can you get that in the next two and a half, three years? I mean, after the election, if you are a United States senator.
Well, we need to win majorities. Right? Democratic Party needs to win majorities, because right now I haven't seen any indication from incumbent Republicans that they want to hold these officers accountable.
Would you support impeachment of cabinet officials?
Of course, yes.
You would, unquestionably.
Yes.
Okay. Did the Biden administration do the right thing or make a mistake in not having more restrictive border enforcement?
They made a mistake. Yes.
Say more.
Yes. We have to have a border. We are a nation of nations have borders for a reason. We can't just have people crossing the border without any kind of process to know who's coming and leaving the country. So we need to have an enforceable border. And I'm very critical of the Biden administration for not enforcing the border as well as they should have. And so now we have this problem where we have an influx of migrants in the country. And now what do we do with them? I support enforcing the border and doing a hard reset, just granting amnesty to those people who've demonstrated that they've been living, working, paying taxes, building our economy. Those people who've been living in this country and doing all those things, they deserve amnesty and a pathway to citizenship. Then we need to enforce the border and have streamline our processes for people to come into this country legally. When we look at capital versus labor, people like our own governor are able to offshore their trusts and then not pay any taxes on the dividends they receive off of that, and that's wrong. Capital can move freely across borders, which allows the ultra-wealthy to evade paying taxes. They're effectively stealing from us. Meanwhile, migrant labor has to go through all these obstacles to try and cross the border to help build our economy. I would like to see the opposite. I would like to see a streamlined process for migrant labor to legally cross the border and come into our country to help build our economy while stopping our capital from flowing out freely.
Not the point, but did you just assert that Governor Pritzker is stealing from us with his tax sheltering policies?
Yes.
All right. Sticking with domestic policy, and this is another question from a listener, do you support guaranteed universal health care?
Yes.
How would that work?
So I get my health care through the VA, and I have seen just how life-changing it can be. In fact, because I get my health care through the VA, it helps me run for office in this instance. I don't have to worry about what happens if I get sick. And so when we look at the numbers, we spend on average about $15,000 per veteran on veterans' health. If we took that metric and applied it to the population of the United States, we're looking at about $5.2 trillion for health care. Our budget, our most recent budget, was $7.1 trillion, I believe. So we're talking about nearly doubling the budget. So the question is, if that's how much it costs, can we afford it? And in the most wealthy country in the world, the answer is yes. The problem is we have a broken tax system, where the tremendous wealth that this country produces stays at the top, and we're not using it or leveraging it to provide people the basic necessities they need, like universal health care.
More domestic policy, social issues, and maybe we can do this as sort of a quick hit although these are complicated issues in some cases. But do you own a personal firearm?
I do.
How do you think about that? How do you relate to voters who would find that abhorrent versus those gun owners who think Democrats in general are, you know, out to get them?
You know, I've not really met any Democrat or liberal-minded person who thinks that private gun ownership is, like, abhorrent. I own a Smith & Wesson MP Shield 9mm compact for self-defense. Being trained in the weapons in the Marine Corps, and I believe in self-defense. I believe everyone has the right to defend themselves and their homes. I don't think that the Second Amendment is unlimited, and that's why we've seen it in many states. They ban fully automatic weapons. I would support a similar assault weapon ban that we had nationally before the sun setted. There's some things we could change about it, because some of the characteristics were more cosmetic about how a firearm looked as opposed to like what it can actually do. When I look at an assault weapon, I'm looking at muzzle velocity, magazine capacity, rate of fire. If it's designed to kill a maximum amount of people at range, that is an assault weapon that's used in the military. And I just don't think we need that personally owned in our homes to defend ourselves. You know, a shotgun does that great, and so does, you know, a sidearm or just a regular rifle. And then people who say that, like, the Democrats are trying to come to get the guns, I haven't seen any single person promote that. I mean, even in Illinois with the assault weapon ban that we have here, no one was taking guns. It was just, we're not selling them anymore. So I don't understand why it's, you know, where that sentiment comes from.
Some people do point to the red flag laws, right? If somebody has mm-hmm. a mental health or domestic
sure,
violence.
Yeah. And I do think the red flag laws are flawed. I mean, we're a red flag state, and we had the shooting up in the north suburbs of Chicago on the 4th of July, right? The Highland Park shooting. Where was the red flag law didn't work there. So there are flaws within it, and there's ways I think that we can improve it.
What do you think is at the root of America's, I guess, do you accept my premise that America has a unique problem compared to other peer nations in terms of mass killing events with gun violence, as well as everyday interpersonal gun violence, right?
Of course.
Do you accept that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What do you think is the root of that then?
I mean, it's got to be a combination of the proliferation of firearms, like how profusely available they are, along with you know, social ills that mostly come from people not being able to afford to live. I think that's where a lot of the gun violence comes from. But we cannot deny the fact that the amount of firearms available contributes to that. I mean, you can look at Sylvia Plath. When she committed suicide, she did so by, you know, sticking her head in an oven and letting the gas slowly kill her. And that was a preferred method of suicide in England at the time. They changed that. They changed the gas they put into their ovens, and that there was a decline in suicide because of that. So there is a correlation, maybe even causal relationship, between what's available to you and will you use it to do something.
And of course, suicide is one of the big consequences of gun violence.
Of course,
often,
yes.
People
yes.
often don't think about it in those terms. Another domestic policy issue: abortion. When does life begin?
I think, first of all, with abortion, the decisions around that, those incredibly difficult decisions, belong with a woman and the doctor. When we consider when life begins, I think it comes down to the viability of the fetus outside of the womb. And that's when we start making the consideration of, you know, if this can live on its own, okay, then we need to start to prioritize the life of the unborn. But that's only if it's not the life of the mother is not being jeopardized. So the life of the mother must always come first, and the well-being of the mother always must come first, and then we consider the viability of the fetus outside of the womb.
Mm. Another domestic issue, there's a great deal of concern right now about young people and social media. What do you think about stronger age restrictions on things like Instagram, TikTok, which I'll remind listeners is actually legally banned? It's just a law that's not being enforced right now.
Yeah, social media is dangerous. I mean, I came into this race as a public school teacher and a veteran. I'm not an influencer, but we were able to amass.
You are filming yourself.
I know,
with your
we are filming
right
ourselves.
Now.
No, I know. Now I am. Now I'm a micro influencer according to some metrics because we have 50,000 followers that we got in 6 months. We've reached over 5 million accounts. And so that's how I'm broadcasting my message without having to pay for expensive ads, right? We made 21 million impressions online without having to pay for advertising. That's the whole idea of this campaign is renewing or remaking, reshaping the idea of political viability. But that being said, getting into social media like that, I've seen what people will comment and say, and it is vicious. And it's a lot of like people who disagree with me politically, probably conservative voters. But I don't get that when I go downstate. When I go into towns, I just insert myself into the communities, and I don't get that vitriol that I get online. And so people definitely, behind the veneer of a screen, it brings out some of the worst aspects of us. And I think that is dangerous, especially at a young level. So I definitely support age restrictions.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have John calling from Springfield. John, thank you for calling in. I understand you wanted to follow up on our price and affordability discussion.
Yes, I want to talk about the high prices at grocery stores and also at restaurants. What I believe they've done is they raised their prices during COVID, but after COVID, they didn't take them down the same amount as they raised them. And then when the tariffs came in, they raised them again. But when they kind of got their supply chain worked out, they didn't lower the prices. So they've used COVID and tariffs as an excuse to gouge us at both restaurants and grocery stores.
All right, John, thanks for sharing your perspective.
So I think price gouging is very real, but I think we have to delineate between small business and big business. Big business is price gouging. I firmly believe that they, if it's not direct collusion, they all just kind of know that they're doing it, and they're artificially inflating prices. When it comes to small business, I think it's incredibly difficult to run a small business, especially in Illinois. There are a lot of restrictions. There are a lot of fees that you have to pay, and it's difficult for small business owners to operate. And so one way that we could help this is by flipping how we treat small business and big business. Because right now, we treat big business as if it's small business, trying to give it everything it can to thrive and corporate subsidies. And then we treat small business as if they are big business with all these restrictions and bureaucracy that they have to go through to try to run their business. So if we flip those things and if we hold big business accountable, we can stop them from price gouging. And then we give the small businesses the freedom they need to be able to lower their prices because they're not having to deal with high taxes and fees associated with operating their business.
Time is getting short on this segment. Maybe we can listen to a voicemail quickly. We had a couple of messages on environmental policy. Gene in Cobden wants to know about that. And Fawn in Champaign.
I would like to ask the political candidates what they are going to do about the data centers. Data centers use energy, a lot of it, and they also use water. And Mahomet Aquifer is a sole source aquifer for our area, East Central Illinois. The concern I have is about the fact that these data centers do use water. So what is their stance on this? And how will they approach the energy that these data centers need?
All right, just about a minute until we need to take a break. Go ahead.
So at the state level in Illinois, I firmly support a moratorium on any further AI data centers. We in our transition from green energy or from coal energy to green energy, we're seeing a shortage in supply, and that's also being made worse by these AI data centers. So we need a moratorium on it in Illinois, and then nationally, we need to create a regulatory body that can effectively regulate these centers across the nation because of the outsized amount of power and water that they use.
Should we ease back on the transition away from coal-fired power plants? Or
we need to transition away from coal, but we need to make sure that we're supplying energy. So we cannot transition away from coal until we have an adequate green supply source.
All right. This is the 21st show. We're speaking with Kevin Ryan, who is a Democratic candidate for the United States Senate, or I should say for the Democratic Party nomination to the United States Senate for the election coming up in March. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. We're going to get to some foreign policy questions and some big picture, small d democracy questions. questions on the other side of this short break. It's the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Kevin Ryan, one of the Democrats running for the United States Senate in Illinois this year for his party's nomination, part of a series of conversations. You can find others at our website, 21stshow.org, 800-222-9455 to join us today, 800-222-9455. So much we could talk about. I do want to touch on foreign affairs, since that is one of the big remits of being a United States senator. What do you think about the Trump administration's capture of Venezuela's president last week?
I think it was a violation of international law, and I think it was a violation of our own constitution in the War Powers Resolution in not consulting Congress beforehand. So they admitted themselves that they had been planning this operation for months but did not consult congressional leadership. Article 1 is in the beginning for a reason. The authority of Congress supersedes the president when it comes to war, the authority of Congress to declare war. So it must, and the War Powers Resolution is meant to address modern concerns of war in the global sense we have today. But the president is supposed to consult with congressional leadership before committing troops, and he did not do that. So I see it's a violation of our own domestic law, and it's a clear violation of international law under Article 2 of the UN Charter.
Of course, we haven't declared war since, 1943, I think. Is the Congress ceded too much power to the executive?
Well, yes, they've ceded too much power to the executive. But even if it's not a formal declaration, the authorizations of use of military force, AUMFs, have been used by Congress to authorize a president to use force. Now, the problem is the AUMF of 2001 for Afghanistan after 9/11 is still on the books, and that's exactly what they're citing to go after whoever they want across the world. So the 2001 AUMF has to be rescinded.
Authorization for use of military force, yes. Which is basically the legal mechanism that allowed the global war on terror.
It's how we declare war in the modern sense.
Yeah. What should U.S. senators be doing to check the executive branch on this?
I mean, assert the War Powers Resolution. And I know it's hard for senators of the Republican Party to go against their president, but we've seen a handful of them doing so. We need more of that, to assert Congress's authority over the president. Because the problem is, when the Constitution was designed, we didn't have these parties. We had a check on the branches, not a check on the parties, right? So Congress has ceded so much of its power to the presidency, what we call the imperial presidency, which goes back to Teddy Roosevelt. And it's kind of worked because we've always had a president who's been level-headed, but now President Trump is not acting level-headed, and he's abusing the imperial presidency, and Congress is not doing anything to assert themselves. Congress needs to assert themselves to reclaim their powers from the presidency. And both parties are guilty of ceding that power, so both parties have to come together and take it back for Congress, the sake of Congress itself.
With everything that's been happening, there have been lawmakers reminding members of the military that they are not supposed to follow illegal orders. We have a voicemail on this from Bill in Pekin.
My question is, in light of all the extraordinary activities that Donald Trump is pursuing in foreign countries, Venezuela, Syria, threats to Mexico, Cuba, my question is, what is the obligation of an active military member when he feels that the orders that he is being asked to carry out are unlawful? Now, that's been raised by Senator Kelly, I realize, and he is being persecuted for that by the administration. But as an individual soldier, what can they actually do to resist illegal orders from their superiors in the military?
Thank you for that message. Billy's referring, of course, to U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, retired astronaut and naval aviator.
So first of all, there's a big difference between if we talk about individual soldiers, the junior enlisted, or talk about the general officers. So it's the responsibility of general officers to ensure that unlawful orders do not get trickled down to company grade officers and the junior enlisted. Because when it comes to the junior enlisted, all orders are presumed to be lawful. the cases, the litmus test that you use to determine if an order is lawful or not is if you could show this to anyone and they would, everyone objectively would say that is unlawful. So a good example is if me as a captain, if I told a sergeant to execute a civilian, that's clearly unlawful. And everyone would say that that is unlawful. And that is when a service member would be in their right to deny that order. But it's important to remember that refusing to obey an order is a very serious thing for a service member to do, and they will be charged under the UCMJ. Now, if they are right, if they are on the right side, if they made the right decision, it will be adjudicated properly, and they will be found doing no wrongdoing. But it will go to a court-martial or some kind of military tribunal because you're refusing an order. So that's why it's a very serious thing to say. Like, it's not just, you know, service members being like, oh, you know what, I don't think that's lawful, I'm not going to do it. It's a very serious thing that you have to make a very serious decision about, and you know that you're putting your own career on the line to do that.
Perhaps not just career, but perhaps freedom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yes, yeah. Yes.
Sticking with the issue of foreign affairs and keeping a watchful eye on the clock, does the United States have an interest in a free Ukraine?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. I believe the United States has an interest in a free and prosperous Europe. And that is why we've invested in our relationships across the Atlantic. And that's why we've been a steadfast leader in NATO. Contrary to what some conservatives will think about NATO not pulling its weight, NATO is not a body that takes money. When we're talking about military investment, the 2%, which is now raised to 5%, is how much they're supposed to be investing in their defense. And I support that. And I support Ukraine being free. First of all, we made a commitment to Ukraine that if they gave up their nuclear weapons after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we would guarantee their security. So what does that say about the United States if in the not too distant past, we're just reneging on our commitments that we make internationally?
Should America continue seeking to be a global superpower?
I like to think of the Greeks. In Isocrates, he said the strongest defense of Athens is not her navy. It's the Athenian spirit. People want to be our friends. And I agree with that with the United States. The soft power that we've developed over the latter half of the 20th century, that is our surest defense, when people want to be our friends. But when we start bullying, when we start trying to just regime change in the Western Hemisphere or in the Eastern Hemisphere, in the Middle East, people don't want to be our friends. This administration is trying to lead a global order based on fear. It's in the United States' interest to have a global order based on the rule of law, individual rights, and democracy. And we want people to be our friends.
Another hot-button foreign affairs issue that has been much discussed in the past few years since Hamas attacked Israel in 2023. Would you say that Israel's response in Gaza constitutes a genocide?
Yes. And having studied international law at the University of Oxford and international law within the military itself, it is clear.
Why? What about it? Because reasonable people will look at this and have different perspectives on it. What is the sort of tipping point for you?
Well, we have to go by a definition, right? So the definition we'll use is the United Nations definition. And they're performing a form of ethnic cleansing in Gaza. And ethnic cleansing is a form of genocide. If you're trying to destroy a population in part or in whole. And the Netanyahu administration has clearly demonstrated that they do not want Palestinians returning to Gaza, that they had no problem leveling major cities in Gaza. And it's because they're trying to ethnically cleanse the area so that they can take it over and not have to worry about Hamas or all the problems that were stemming out of Gaza. They just want that problem to go away. And the best way to make it go away is to ethnically cleanse and get that part of the population out.
What should the United States do about that?
I think the United States needs to stop all military aid and funding to Israel until the current regime is held accountable for its crimes against humanity. And also, we cannot return to that funding or support until a new administration is elected that recognizes the state of Palestine and invests in good faith in rebuilding Gaza.
A new Israeli administration.
Yes.
Should the United States recognize a Palestinian state?
Of course.
Who would they be recognizing?
I mean, there's a Palestinian Authority.
In the West Bank?
Yes.
What about Gaza?
Well, the Palestinian Authority needs to take responsibility for that.
I guess that's one of the criticisms that people who have about recognizing a state is like, what are you really recognizing? Because it's so fractious.
Sure.
Among the Palestinian people still.
Sure. But, I mean, the Palestinian Authority would be what we'd recognize.
Hmm. Okay, we've talked about domestic policy. We've talked about foreign affairs. I want to end in the time we have remaining with some sort of a small D Democratic functionary things in the Senate. We've already talked about the filibuster. Would you vote for a new Democratic leader to replace Chuck Schumer? Sam in Springfield specifically wanted to know about that.
Yes, I would. I believe it's time for a new generation to step up and lead. The current Democratic leadership is playing by an antiquated playbook that is unsuited for the stormy present that we now find ourselves in.
What about restructuring the Supreme Court?
Like packing the Supreme Court?
Packing it or, you know, imposing term limits on new members. There are creative ideas.
Sure. I mean, I'm very supportive of term limits. I'm also supportive of expanding the Supreme Court to reflect the expanding nature of the nation. Those things do require constitutional amendments, so that will be, you know, an uphill battle, but I certainly support them.
Like a campaign finance constitutional.
Yes, except that has the bipartisan support that we need.
I want you to put yourself in the mind of a young male voter, quite possibly black or Latino, who voted for President Trump in 2024. What do you think that person was not hearing from Democratic candidates?
That's a great question. Probably a lot. I mean, I got asked this question before, and I think the first answer is that people don't vote in block, right? There is no black vote. There is no Hispanic vote. People vote as individuals, and we need to treat them as individuals, and we need to meet them where they're at. And I think the Democratic Party has a problem with showing up. And that's what I've noticed that of all the places I've gone across the state. I've gone to a lot of places where Democrats don't show up. Just this week, this past weekend, I went down to Chatham on the south side of Chicago for a forum, and the three leading candidates didn't show up. They were invited, but they chose not to come because it was kind of a smaller forum. They would rather spend their time with donors trying to raise money, and the Democratic Party has proven that they're really good at raising money, but they're not good at winning. They outspent Trump by $500 million, but they still lost. I think it's because they don't show up. They don't show up to these communities, and they feel forgotten. I think that's not just black and Latina. It's rural America, too. And I think that's why we've lost working class union workers and rural Americans, because Democrats have stopped showing up for them.
And, I mean, that does get to the educational polarization that a lot of people have pointed to as one of the reasons that the votes have gone the way they have, right? College-educated voters are going overwhelmingly for Democrats. Some people say that's shaping the parties in a way that, among Democrats, is going to alienate working class voters. Yeah. How do you rectify that?
Again, it's showing up. I think showing up is half of everything in life. And listen, I've got excuse me. I got two advanced degrees and a degree from the University of Illinois. But I show up to these rural towns, and I talk to people, and I meet them where they're at, and I understand their problems. That's why I can talk about how shutting down a coal plant affects people in Havana, Illinois, or how Russian olive in Sullivan, Illinois, affects hunting grounds, because I talk to these people, and I listen to the issues that affect them, and they feel heard. At the end of the day, it's almost like this innate human craving that people have is to just know that they matter. Whether when you're a kid, you want your affirmation from your parents. When you're an adult, you want affirmation from your partner. As a citizen, you want affirmation from your representative government that your voice matters and you care. And you cannot relay that unless you show up and genuinely, in good faith, listen to people.
Last question. We have seen a decline in trust in institutions in American life from the news media like us, universities, the law, the courts. Societal cohesion seems to be eroding. What steps do you think we should be taking to try and rebuild trust in our society?
Well, I think we need to prioritize the health of our democracy, and the Democratic Party has a big responsibility in that because they say that we're the party for defending democracy, and yet in Illinois, half of our legislature is elected without facing an opponent in the primary or the general election. So we need to take money out of politics to start. Then we need publicly financed campaigns, ranked choice voting, and nonpartisan open primaries. If we do those things, we will have more competitive elections, and more competitive elections will produce elected officials who are more representative of the people, more responsive of the people, and that will build the trust. But until we do that, our government is going to continue to exist insularly from the people it's supposed to represent, because the path to success in our democracy is money, and 1% of donors fund 80% of all campaigns. So our government works for that 1%. That's why I'm trying to break that mold, because we can talk about issues all day, every day, all we want, but nothing will change until we disenthrall our democracy from the control of the 1%.
Kevin Ryan is seeking the Democratic nomination for the United States Senate. This is part of an ongoing series of conversations we've had with candidates. You can find more at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. And on that note, coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll continue this series with another Democrat, Steve Botsford, who works with his family's real estate and biotech firms. You can let us know what questions you have for him. Our voicemail line is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. You can find that and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Khan. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.